Hello, and welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on Vietnam. And we are so honored right now to finally, after several attempts, be able to talk to Billy Two Feathers. She is a Lakota Indian. Is that correct, Billy?
I am adopted into Lakota, yes.
Okay.
And I am recognized as such by the tribal members, family members, and the elders.
Explain that to me. How do you get adopted into a tribe?
How do you get adopted into a family anywhere?
Well, I guess this. That's a good point. Both Rick and I have adopted kids, so yes.
But it's not done on paper. It's just you become emotionally attached to people, and you say, "I would like to call you my son or my daughter," or you could call me dad or mom, whatever.
So it's kind of a bond then, basically, yeah.
It is a definite bond.
An emotional bond, and yes. Yeah.
And in my case, I try to follow Lakota spirituality as well.
Okay. That sounds good. And so tell me a little bit about, Billy, when we first talked, you lived in this area. You lived in the Bremerton area, didn't you? And you're very familiar. You mentioned you'd gone to powwows down here in Yakima and all over the place.
During the Korean War, my dad was contracted to the Navy to do pipe fitting and plumbing on the ships as a civilian contractor. So because he was a government employee when Mom had me on the day that Harry Truman was born, I was born at the Naval Hospital. In fact, my birth certificate states that a copy was sent to the National Security Agency. So, yeah, at just a couple of minutes of living, the NSA had my number.
Yes. And a little bit off subject, but did your father have any trouble with, I know there was a lot of asbestos going around in those ships and things like
I don't know. He died of a heart attack at the age of 56.
Wow, that's pretty young. So,
yeah.
Well, let's talk a little. Go ahead.
You asked about Yakima. The folks moved from, after the Korean War, Dad wound up in Yakima and commuted to Bremerton until they started up down in Hanford, where they were doing the building for the nuclear depository, and he did the plumbing. He did a lot of the plumbing there too.
Oh, okay. Well, let's start. Go ahead. No.
After the job finished, then we moved back. We moved to Minnesota, where his parents and my mom's parents lived.
Uh huh. And now you say you live in a place where your closest neighbor is a quarter mile away.
Closest human neighbor.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. The bear was by the other day and made a mess of our suet feeders that we had out. And I think it might have been out last night when I was walking the dogs because they started barking at something. I heard some kind of a growl. I couldn't be sure if it was a wolf or if it was a bear, but considering it didn't come into the yard, I'm thinking it was probably a bear. And I brought the dogs in, we locked up, and everybody went about their business.
That's the way it should be. Well, tell me, you know, you sent me some pictures, and the one picture of you is in your army outfit. You're a pretty tough little nut. I mean, you look tough in that picture, Billy.
Well, it's
Did you feel tough?
No, I'm just me.
Yeah. Okay.
Some people attribute the fact that I survived with a 12-minute life expectancy in Vietnam, and I only got a scratch on the cheek from an AK. I went to 13 schools before I graduated, so I had to learn how to fight.
Right.
And
by 13 schools, you mean like artillery, weapons?
No. These are public schools prior to graduation.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Okay.
And then when I went into, after I graduated, I started college and I wound up majoring in partying for the first semester and was about ready to get thrown out. So instead of being thrown out, I dropped out of school, looked for work, couldn't find it, and enlisted into the Army Airborne, and I went to infantry school. I was trying to hide and deny who I was feeling on the inside because I felt different. I felt female.
Uh-huh.
And back in the 60s when I graduated from high school, had I let anybody know, it could have been a death sentence.
Sure.
So I went into the paratroopers, and I had thoughts of going into special forces. My scores were high enough where I could have, but they offered me what's known as Pathfinder School. And that was a very intensive course. We needed 90% accuracy on all phases of our training. That's whether it's land navigation with a compass and a map, communications with various types of radio, parachuting, rappelling from helicopters. I mean, I saw people slide down 200-foot ropes from hovering helicopters, burn their inner thighs in their hands because they refused to follow the proper method of rappelling. Oh, Lord, small weapons, both communist as well as U.S. weapons. We had to know how to not only operate them but maintain them because, well, if we were out of ammunition and there happened to be, say, an AK-47 handy, we had to know how to use it if need be.
I would also imagine that just in that environment where everything is wet and damp and at the same time dusty and windy, that just, you know, keeping a weapon maintained has got to be a kind of an all-time job, you know.
Well, you got used to it, and there were various things you could do. But you always checked your weapon at night and the first thing in the morning, you know. Pathfinder School gave me the opportunity to, they encouraged us to think out of the box
mm-hmm.
on solving problems. As an example, we learned a way to use various methods, and I won't say it on the radio because don't need to add that to things happening in life, but we learned how to use various everyday things for the military as blasting caps for deck corridor C4. And that cut down on some of the weight that I had to carry in Vietnam because I carried a small demolition kit of deck cord and C4 along with blasting caps and fuses. But when I didn't have the blasting caps, there was also a method where I could jerry-rig, so to speak, a blasting cap that was very, very sufficient.
Probably use it from a shell or even...
I'm not going to say what from,
right.
because there's too many people out there that might want to experiment.
Right. But and I even remember as kids, you know, we could we'd take a magnifying glass and could do things. So, you know, if you want to be creative, I guess you could, you know, you can certainly be creative about those kinds of things. And, you know, we talked even about the last time some of the booby traps and, you know, taking old shells and those kinds of things.
Yeah. And, you know, the North Vietnamese and the NVA, or the NVA and the Viet Cong were very creative, and the NVA were very, very well disciplined for the most part, and very knowledgeable about their skills. So I, you know, if I have to say that they were good fighters.
Yeah.
The ones I ran across. I spent 6 months in Anshaw Valley. In fact, on the 21st of this month, which is just a couple of days from now, it'll be the anniversary of when we went into Anshaw Valley in 1968 with the 101st Airborne Division. And I was embedded as a pathfinder, and one of my jobs was to go back to the rear and pick out the landing zones for all of the infantry companies and the Recondo platoons within the 1st Brigade of the 101st. They used dental work as my cover so that I had a legitimate reason to go back to the rear, although very few people got to have dental work done if they were an infantry person or even in an artillery unit.
So you went back to the rear to have dental work done.
And I did have an abscess tooth pulled.
Uh-huh.
And then I was met by a lieutenant when I walked out, and I looked at the Jeep that was all shiny. I mean, had it been stateside, it would have been a Corvette all shined and waxed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he was standing there looking like a poster child for the airborne, and I could tell by looking at his rank and the brass that showed which branch of the Army he was in that he would never be going out to the field.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and I had a scar on my right cheek that was pretty bright at the time because it was only about 6 months old after being kissed by that AK-47. And I hadn't had a change of clothes in over a month. And he asked who I was, and I told him, and he said, "Get in. I have to take you to brigade headquarters." I said, "Who's going to be there?" He says, "I don't know. I don't ask questions. It's none of my business." I said, "Do you know what this is about?" "I don't know. I don't ask questions. It's none of my business." And this went on for the entire trip. And it was about a 2-mile jaunt going through various rear areas for different units, including my battalion. And I'm waving at sergeants and people I knew as we went through various areas. And their eyes got big. So I get to brigade headquarters, and he leaves. Sergeant Major asks where he went, and I said, "I think he went to change clothes because I thought he was going to fill his britches." I had a reputation. But I walked in, reported to the general brigade commander, who looked at me, said, "You know, the battalion commander is here from the infantry battalions. You will be working with them in the future, so just use their call sign." And there's beer in that cooler. There's soda in that cooler. Take your pick. Your job is to put the puzzle together. And I sat down at a coffee table. Next thing I know, he hands me a stack of aerial photos.
And this is when you were deciding where the landing fields would be, is that?
Well, this was part of it.
Uh-huh.
He handed me a stack of aerial photos that overlapped, and I asked the altitude. I said, 25,000. He said, yeah. I said, okay. So I laid them out on the table, I mean, just like you would a jigsaw puzzle. And I said, it doesn't look familiar. Have you got a map? And he pulls out a map, and I said, ah. I said, I still haven't been to this area. He said, no, and we don't know for sure if we're going to. This meeting never took place. You are to find areas to use as landing zones and mark them on my map for each of the infantry companies and each of the Recondo platoons from the battalions. So I picked out 12 landing zones. I did not pick out who was going where. That wasn't my job. That was his. And he looked at his map. He looked at the aerial photos. And he said, can you mark them? I said, sure, on the photos. So I did with just a little dot on each one. And he said, okay. He said, you haven't got any duty today for the rest of the day. You go back tomorrow on a helicopter. Anybody asks, you had dental work done.
Hmm.
That's so, proven.
So those kinds of things were pretty well kept under wraps. And once you decided where a landing zone would be, would they then come in with like a daisy cutter or something and create the landing zone?
Let's try inserting a squad and setting up the landing zone where it's operated by a compass, a map, a radio, and a person that knows what they're doing.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
That's it. They did. Now, I was told that I said, I don't, you know, before I was excused, I said, I still don't know where this is. He says, it's Ashaw Valley. And I said, the Valley of Death. He said, where did you ever hear that? He said, I know where I heard it. Where did you hear it? And I said, up on High Van Pass, when we were securing Highway 1 between Da Nang and Hue during the second week of Tet, I said, we were there at High Van Pass with the airborne rangers from the Arvins. He said, you have a way of getting in with foreign troops. He said, I understand you're a member of the you're an honorary member of the Queen Cobra from the ninth, when you were with the 9th Infantry. And I said, yeah. And he said, and how well did you get along with the Arvin Rangers? I said, well, I got to fire their air-cooled 30 caliber machine gun during a mad minute while we were there, and had a good time with them, enjoyed my time, made some friends, got to know an interpreter. He said, okay, that's where I heard it, was from one of their officers. They called Ashaw Valley the Valley of Death. Now, when you leave, understand, this meeting, this briefing, never took place, unless it happens. And even then, you're not able to talk about it. Except to battalion staff on up.
One of the things that you mentioned, Billy, in your in the written information you sent to me was, you said, I was an Army Pathfinder most of the time, and I was embedded as an infantryman. I was also a medic after ours was killed, and I led a recon team for about 2 months. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
About which?
About the, well, yeah, there you go. I sound like I ask questions like a politician, don't I? I do a speech for 2 minutes and then and it's a yes or no answer. About the medic was killed. And then you had to take over, correctly?
Well, what happened was we were on the way to Fire Base Bastogne. This was before, this was a couple, well, about a month before that briefing. And I got to know the medic pretty well for our platoon. In fact, when he got a Bowie knife for his birthday, he gave me his buck knife, his hunting knife, because he had gotten that for Christmas. And he got this brand new Bowie knife. And he had taught me what was in the case, or in his aid bag. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And how to use it. And how to use it. There were instances where he was patching someone up and he'd call me over to do two things. One is to cover his back while he was working on the guy, and second of all, to observe what he was doing so I knew how to use it in case something happened to him, whether he got wounded or killed. Unfortunately, he got killed. It was a swift shot, one shot from a sniper. He was on a ridge patching up one of the recondos. And the rest of the week that he was busy getting shelled by mortars, so we couldn't get over there at the time. And when I heard about him being hit, it was like being hit in the gut with a 16-pound sledgehammer. But at the end of the day, when we finally consolidated and we took a hill that we were going to be on that night, the platoon sergeant, Ernie Crane, otherwise known as Ranger Crane, because he had been an instructor at Ranger School for 10 years after the Korean War, and most of the senior NCOs who were Rangers had him as an instructor, and they were terrified of this guy because he was so well-respected. He could look at a person, and a lot of people would just cringe, and I'd just stand there grinning. You know, he and I had this unusual relationship since that ambush, and when I called him my own medevac. But he walked up to me at the end of the day after Doc Brown was had his body shipped out, and he said, "I got two things for you." He threw the aid bag at me. He says, "Well, Doc, you got another job." And he said, "By the way, that's not the only thing." I understood he gave you his buck knife after he got his Bowie knife. Well, you get the Bowie knife, too. It's part of his will. So I got the Bowie knife, and I handed off the buck knife to a kid, believe it or not, who was from Spokane.
Wow. Wow. You know, that's pretty amazing. What, you know...
And I carried that aid bag for about, let's see, about 5 months.
Uh-huh.
Wow. And about 2 weeks later, we were into some real heavy stuff right before we took what became Fire Base Bastogne. And we took a lot of casualties. We had a platoon of tanks on the road with us. And the North Vietnamese dropped hand grenades from the trees into the open hatches of these tanks. And I helped patch this one guy up, and then when it was finally secure enough, we brought in helicopters for medevacs, and three of them came in at once. I'm holding an IV on this guy that I had patched up, and I'm holding the microphone in the other hand, and I've got people watching my back. And the first bird lands, and out comes his colonel, and he says, "Where's the head medic?" And I said, "Over by the body bags, they're doing triage." He looked and said, "Who patched this guy?" I said, "I did." He said, "Wait a minute, you just brought in the helicopters. What are you, special forces?" I said, "No, I'm a pathfinder, I'm embedded." He said, "What? Pathfinder? Black Hat? I said, yeah. He said, geez. So he says, you want that medical badge? I said, no, I'm a Pathfinder. He says, all you got to do is say you're a medic. I'll get it for you. I said, no, I'm a Pathfinder. He says, okay. He says, do you need anything? I said, yeah, a replacement medic. He said, you got to wait for 3 months, Doc. He says, I can't get one to you for 3 months. So you're it, whether you're a Pathfinder or whatever.
So you got another job at that time. And let me ask you this, Billy, because I know we're kind of running out of time here. But I really appreciate your time. You know, I've always said that in my life, I've had bad experiences and I've had good experiences and lots in between, but I've learned something from every single one of them. I've had people say to me that they wouldn't give up the experience that they had in Vietnam for $1 million, but they wouldn't go back and do it again for $2 million. What did you learn? Is there something that you learned or brought with you when you were in Vietnam? Is there something that stayed with you the rest of your life?
Yeah. Because of my job and doing reconnaissance, we snatched an officer and we were able to destroy some caches of weapons as a result. I didn't destroy them, but the jets did when they dropped their bombs on top of the locations. Okay. The one thing that I can take from that war is that no war is civil. You know, they talk about the Civil War here in the States. It wasn't civil. No war is civil. And if you break it down to the raw basics, the person that has a rifle in their hand pointing at another person has more in common with them. They each have more in common with each other than they have differences.
Good point. That's an excellent point. And I agree with you 100%, Billy. And you know what? I'm going to get out there to Wisconsin and see my relatives out there. And I'm going to make a special trip up to see you. And I'm going to find you and the dogs and the bear. And I'm probably going to mix a little of that maple syrup with some bourbon. And we'll see how it tastes. So,
well, it's been worse than that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Billy, and I'll be in touch, and I'll let you know when this is on the air, and you've been great, and I'll say hello to everybody for you out here.
Thank you. Have
a good one.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.